Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report Washington Roundtable. I'm your host, Vagram Radian. Congress is out of session, but hopes are running high that when lawmakers return next week, they'll pass the long-delayed Ukraine supplemental. That's the hope NATO leaders expressed at the alliance's 75th anniversary gathering, during which leaders unfortunately handed Russia a victory by capitulating to Moscow's demand that no Western troops be deployed to Ukraine. Volodymyr Zelensky raises the draft age, Moscow steps up its attacks, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen visits Beijing as Japanese Prime Minister Kishida prepares to visit the United States. Taiwan suffers its worst earthquake in more than two decades, demonstrating its preparedness, competence, resilience, and cohesion, sending the world a message. And Washington delivers Israel an ultimatum after seven aid workers are killed in a Gaza airstrike. Joining us today to discuss all this and more are Dr. Patrick Cronin, the Asia-Pacific Security Chair at the Hudson Institute Think Tank, former Pentagon Europe Chief Jim Townsend, now with the Center for a New American Security, and a co-host of the Brussels Sprouts podcast, a must for anybody interested in the Transatlantic Alliance, who is also doing his teaching stint now in Paris at Sciences Po, and former Pentagon Comptroller Dr. Dov Zakheim, who counts the Center for Strategic and International Studies among his many affiliations. He is back from Japan, and we're really looking forward to getting his insights, and I recommend that people check out Dov's piece that appeared today in The Hill. The Biden-Kishida summit should set the stage for a unified U.S.-Japanese military command, which I think all of us would agree is very overdue. And for our audience, as Congress is out of session, one of our regulars, Michael Herson, the president of American Defense International, will be off this week, but will be joining us again next week. Everybody, welcome back. It's a pleasure having you on. Dov, I know this is, you know, generally Michael's focus, and we talk about the supplemental hopes are running high that when Congress gets back in session, there is going to be you know, more money for Ukraine, especially as the situation for the Ukrainians grows dire, and the Russians are stepping up their attacks. Zelensky lowered the draft age by 2 years to try to augment the country's ranks, and it's expected that in the wake of the Crocus City Hall terror attack by ISIS-K, there is likely to be a mobilization of some kind coming from the Russians as well. Let me shift to sort of the broader storyline here and the global impacts of dysfunction in Washington, effectively. You spent more than a week in Japan, where you participated in a whole series of gatherings, formal meetings, informal meetings, and the like. What were some of your takeaways, and how is all this chaos playing in Japan? You talked about that a little bit last week, but you've had a little bit of time now to reflect on the visit and some of the storylines from this week and how they're perceived over there. Just give us your broader take as we, you know, celebrate the NATO 75, but still quite a lot of chaos in the alliance that people around the world are watching.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, the whole notion that somehow you can separate Europe from Asia and that what goes on in Europe doesn't matter to Asia is simply wrong. And it's something I think that Patrick has emphasized over the last couple of months, actually. The Japanese are watching our behavior. Obviously, there's a lot of apprehension as to who will be the next president. And there's one other thing, and that is how much is the United States really going to devote to its presence and its operations in East Asia? The Japanese, as I write in The Hill today, they've got a longer term problem. I mean, they are committed to doubling the percentage that they spend on of GDP that they spend on defense. And they're going to do it, and they'll do it within the number of years they said they'll do it. This is a very determined leadership that wants to walk away from the old pacifist paradigm, and they're doing that, and they have public support for that. The problem is this is an aging society. You know, when you walk around the streets of Tokyo, you see kids, but you don't see a lot of them. What you do see are a lot of older folks, and as the society continues to age and the population continues to shrink, that means the tax base is going down while the expenditure on welfare, which is still not very high, say, relative to ours, but has been climbing, is going to continue to climb. So the question then becomes, how do they maintain the commitment that they're making and that they're going to realize. But how do they maintain it beyond, say, 2030? That's a major question. It's also a question for us because we've got budget pressures, which is why I think what Kishida and Biden are going to agree on, which will be promotion of both the commander in Japan and the Japanese commander of Japanese defense forces, will be 4 stars and joint training and the like. That's a first step. It's not enough because unless we get complete synergies between the two militaries, they're not going to be able to cope with the budget pressures. I think is one major lesson. And of course, another major lesson is how do you deal with the uncertainties that are coming out of Washington? When we talk about still question marks about whether we're going to fund Ukraine, out in East Asia, they say, okay, well, what does that mean for Taiwan? What does that mean for funding the European, the Pacific Initiative, which, by the way, has never really been funded to the level it should have been? I mean, it's sort of, well, here's what we're spending on the Pacific, so we're going to call that the Pacific Initiative. Well, you know, you can play that kind of shell game, but if you're out in East Asia, shell games don't work. So I think there's a lot of credibility at stake here, American credibility. And given where Japan is going and the major turnaround that you're seeing out there, they need to know that we're still credible and that we're still reliable. And right now, that's a huge question mark.
I would point out that at least the Pacific Defense Initiative does have $9 billion in it and does include for the first time some things that more of what Indo-Pacific commanders have been asking for than unfortunately has been the case for a number
of
years.
Yeah,
but your point is well taken, though.
Look, one other thing. If you look at what the PDI shortfall was some years ago, a couple of years back, and where it is now, the Pacific Command is asking for a lot more because the shortfall has grown. So yes, we're actually spending some real new money on the defense initiative, but it ain't anywhere near what we've really said we were going to spend.
Agreed, Dov. And I would say that this step that we're taking is also one that is long overdue to try to shore up and add a little bit more robust structure to the strategic, cooperation, because we were basically two nations sort of operating in parallel, trying to defend Japan. I mean, it was just sort of an odd thing that we're addressing some of those flaws and gaps in it. Jim, let me go over to you, right? NATO commemorated its unity, reaffirmed its purpose this week, April 4, yesterday being the 75th anniversary of the founding of the Atlantic Alliance. As the New York Times' great reporter, Lara Jakes, wrote, the alliance wants to show support for Ukraine, but only do so much, right? The U.S. and Germany were opposed to Jens Stoltenberg's idea of NATO playing a central role in coordinating Ukraine support. They like Washington being in the driver's seat on that and driving that, right? Giving a little bit of separation to the alliance. So it's not the alliance at war with Russia, even though it appears that the United States and the West are at war with Russia, right? I mean, Japan is an important contributor to all of this, as well as Asian nations. Everyone torpedoed France's rightful idea that troops be considered in Ukraine. They're both sovereign nations. So, you know, okay, Russia doesn't like it. And Shoigu delivered a demarche. And, you know, we all folded our cards and we're like, oh, no, you know, we're never going to do that, which is absurd and is a capitulation as far as I'm concerned. And then, you know, Ukraine accession to the alliance is completely off the table, something that Washington and Germany have said, right, when the meeting happens in July, and it's happening in July because people couldn't get their act together and book it for April the 4th, which I think is absurd. And you've already discussed that. From your standpoint, what were the high notes? What were the low notes? What were your takeaways as somebody who watched all of this very closely and spent, you know, frankly, 4 decades of your life, Jim, on alliance matters. So we thank you for your service.
Yeah, thank you very much. At least someone thanks me for my service. You know, I guess there's a couple things. One is it was pretty significant that what they're doing with the idea of the fund, the $100 billion over 5 years, NATO fund to support Ukraine. That was significant, since that this is a NATO fund, so it's NATO getting up close and personal with the Ukraine crisis. They're not operating through other allies. They're not kind of having a back seat. They've decided now to move NATO closer to the front line. And so this fund has NATO providing itself as an institution assistance to Ukraine. So that's I felt that was really important. Also, it's the so-called, protecting it from Trump, Trump-proofing, that this is something that gives NATO a facility to provide funding if the U.S. stops altogether doing that. But the Trump-proofing as well for the Ramstein group, I thought was important as well. I understand why the Pentagon, I know the Pentagon hates that. I know it. The Pentagon would rather be in charge of it. They'd rather run it. They feel they're more action-oriented, et cetera, et cetera. However, I think putting it into NATO puts more NATO skin in the game and allied skin in the game, as far as I'm concerned. So I'd rather them go ahead and do that. I mean, this is part of Europe stepping up is having this go under NATO, have NATO run it, have the U.S. run it, but do it in NATO. You know, I mean, there's ways to do this that shouldn't make the Pentagon feel so hurt, you know. And so I think I would like to see that happen. And again, it gets NATO closer to the front line. So those things coming out of the ministerial, and again, decisions haven't been made. They're looking at the details, et cetera. But if that's what some of the deliverables are for the summit, I'm in favor of that. As much as I know it hurts the Pentagon to lose control of the Ramstein group, I think that a lot of what we have seen, the back and forth on troops going into Ukraine and what Macron has said and the reactions from Europe, this kind of thing. You know, there's a lot of stuff that's happening behind the scenes. I've heard from some colleagues here. They've given me a rundown on what's happening behind the scenes in some of the allied governments, and there's a lot more happening. And as usual at NATO, you know, it's never over. It's just never over till it's over, if you will. And I think as we get closer to the summit, I think we're going to see some things happening that aren't apparent right now. And also, I think in terms of providing assistance to Ukraine, you know, the so-called boots on the ground, that really has never been combat forces. This has never been trigger pullers going in. You know, this has been backfilling for the Ukrainians. It's been trainers that are in Ukraine doing the training. I think that kind of thing is going on anyway. I don't think it's well known. But the thing is, a lot of this stuff are trial balloons, and a lot of it is getting nations used to talking about this and thinking about this that would have been unthinkable last year. So let's see what happens as we get closer to July. I'm not predicting some huge moment that's going to move the needle, but I think we're getting closer to what might be the kinds of things that we'd want to see from Europe. I think in terms of Ukraine, though, having them be given membership in July, that's not going to happen. I will say, though, that there's other alternatives that are out there. We've seen papers written about them. They're being considered. So I don't think that's quite over yet. I don't think we know what NATO is going to say in July. So we're going to have to still see that. And then, you know, we'll have to see what happens in the next couple of weeks. So it's not over till it's over.
Right. And the alliance has been very good at saying never, 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 never. Yes. Never, 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 right. Never, never. Right. Yes. Right. So
that's right.
And I remind everybody that when the original agreement was struck, and Germany was a founding member of the alliance, it was West Germany that was a founding member of the alliance. And, you know, the country was partitioned and stayed that way for another four decades, right? So, you know, I mean, at some point when that front stabilizes, it's not unrealistic that you could have, Ukraine being part of the alliance, because it looks like it's already on a timetable to be able to get into the European Union. And the European Union has some pretty tough mutual defense standards, ultimately, as well, that then pulls the alliance into it. Patrick, from your perspective, what are the Chinese seeing when they see this? Right, on the one hand, it's the world's and one of history's most successful political alliances with military capabilities that is increasingly focused on the Indo-Pacific, and yet the Chinese are pretty good right? Students are trying to draw lessons from anything that happens anywhere in the planet that could at some point affect them, right? What do you think Chinese are seeing? And broadly, what are you seeing as, you know, an international security analyst, you know, even before you're, you know, a leading, you know, Asia analyst?
Well, the main observation remains the coming together of the Western coalition in both Asia and Europe as a result of Russia's invasion back in 2022. And that's what Dove is alluding to when he says that, you know, Japan's not going to look back. Japan is moving forward with a doubling of their defense spending, and 2% is the goal. And it's going to happen, even if it's not under Prime Minister Kishida, it'll be under his successor. But it will happen, and that's largely because of what Russia's aggression meant in Asia, as well as in Europe. And I think that's a message that will be hammered home when Prime Minister Kishida is at the White House and delivering a speech before Congress this coming week, the first time in 9 years since Abe really set down the vision of a free and open Indo-Pacific. China's also looking at what they can get out of Russia, and Russia's intelligence ships have been shadowing the coast of Japan this past week as Chinese ships and aircraft have been circling around Yonaguni and Ishigaki and Miyako Islands, the Southwest Island chain, as the Japanese are building up that Southwest Island chain in defense of China. The Chinese are also watching the debate over extended deterrence. You know, can they sow doubt about America's alliance credibility? This is a question that North Korea has been forcing upon the South Koreans. And now we see in the Wall Street Journal this weekend a very interesting discussion about whether Europe is going to start to rekindle the debate about the reliability of extended deterrence. So China would love to work with Russia, North Korea, and Iran to sow doubt about the credibility of this coalition that has come together. So that may sound like a contradiction. On the one hand, they're watching the fact that this potentially anti-China coalition could be coming together. At the same time, they're hoping to keep it fragmented. I think this axis of of these revisionist powers, though, is also coming together, and that's what at least China is trying to promote that narrative. But when they step on the world stage, you know, whether it's the G20 or on global economy, they get dragged down by Russia rather than benefiting from this axis. They don't benefit really from North Korea and Russia in that sense. They only benefit from the fact that North Korea and Russia and Iran pose threats to their neighbors. That's right. When China likes to capitalize on it. So those are some of the elements that I see, I think, in China as they think about NATO. Obviously, if Japan is able to open up a NATO liaison office, something they've been wanting to do, something that could be announced in July at this NATO summit in Washington, I think the Chinese will undoubtedly find ways to respond to that, because they don't like the idea that international community could be arrayed against Chinese power.
I think that that's an overdue move, and I think it would send all of the right signals ultimately. And we're going to get your take, Patrick, in just a moment on Kishida's visit, as well as the JAFIS, the Japan, Philippines, U.S. Alliance that is also deepening, something obviously that has existed for decades. Dove, let me come back to you for a second. And first, issue a correction. Germany entered NATO not in 1949 as a founding member. I was mistaken about that. It's 1955. And so I apologize to everybody for having made that mistake. That said, in 1955, we were still at the height of the Cold War. You know, okay, so for 35 years or 34 years, a divided Germany was a central part of the Atlantic Alliance. Dove, I want to get your sense on all of this and some of the messages coming out of, you know, Brussels and sort of step one of the 75th anniversary commemorations. And what did you make of sort of the alliance's capitulation to the rhetoric coming out of Moscow about, you know, Europe, of Western powers putting troops in Ukraine? Again, I think Emmanuel Macron deserves credit for raising the issue. There are military personnel from all alliance nations that are in the country. Whatever it is they're doing, from training, you know, or helping target weapons or what have you, or intelligence collaboration, or you want to call it embassy security or whatever, every nation is in their rights to do that with another sovereign power. So you know, what did you take from the messaging? And, you know, I want to bridge this to the Havana Syndrome conversation as well, because if I was Russia, I'm sort of getting away with everything. Every time I threaten you with nuclear weapons or something else, you guys sort of have a tendency of backing down. I'm doing blatantly the Havana Syndrome attacks, the 60 Minutes, Der Spiegel and the insider Christo Grozhev's organization did enormous reporting to show that Americans, many of them counter-espionage people, are being subject to high-power microwave attacks or high-frequency microwave attacks or high-frequency and high-power microwave attacks at home, not just abroad, but also at home with debilitating impacts. We know it's the Russians. We've even caught the Russians red-handed, and yet we refuse to blame Russia because we don't know how to deal with it, right? Dov, and I want to kind of go around, does this Havana Syndrome thing drive people to take this a little bit more seriously and to be a little bit tougher in standing up to Russia and take nothing off the table? Because the Russians literally are taking nothing off the table. Go ahead.
Well, you started with Macron, so let me just give you my take. I think one of the reasons that Macron feels confident, and this is not the first time he's raised this, as you know, is because they have a nuclear deterrent. And while everybody poo-poos it, he's basically telling Putin, do you really want to start this thing? I'm not afraid of your nuclear threats. I wish the White House would have the same guts, because they're simply threats. Now, will anything come of it? I don't know how Macron can really pull this off, because he doesn't have Germany on his side. And the Franco-German axis is the most important, I think, inside Europe. And without them, and the Brits have been notably quiet about this, the other nuclear power in Europe. So,
but Lord Cameron has poured a lot of cold water on it and said, you know, that there should be no Western troops,
right,
or whatever he said.
Right. So exactly. They're not supportive. So without the British, without the Germans, Macron is basically making a statement, but not much more. But you got to give him credit, because essentially he's telling the Russians, I'm ready to call your bluff, even if nobody else is. And that's important. And maybe at some point it'll sink into the White House, too. And talk about sinking into the White House. Look, we've known for a while, obviously, that what the Russians are doing, it's the same self-deterrence that has essentially poisoned everything we try to do in support of Ukraine. And I would also point out that on the one hand, you have this kind of Russian behavior. On the other hand, you have China continuing to steal whatever it can from our intellectual property and anything else. And I think that points to the fact that the whole debate of whether it's Europe or whether it's East Asia is nonsensical. We have a double threat, both in military terms and in the kinds of terms that we're talking about now. Theft on the one hand, poisoning and murder on the other. We continue to think, because it'll become far too costly to have a defense posture that deals with both of these enemies, we continue to think that somehow if we ignore one or the other, primarily the Russian threat, we'll get away with it. Well, we're not getting away with it. They're just hitting us right now.
Indeed. Jim, your take on sort of the back down, right? I mean, the climb down on the French proposal, but then more broadly, right? I mean, what American impotence at the face of this kind of blatant attack? And the Russians are killing people, right? I mean, not just recently in Spain, but they have killed people in Washington, Berlin, UK, France, like all over the world. We're now realizing, and all over the United States, in fact, you know, people have died while jogging. They've allegedly died in their sleep, and all of them have now Russian fingerprints on it, right? I mean, this is the sort of bad behavior that you just need to police, right? I mean, what is the message? And are you picking up from anybody? Because I have to say, the French tend to be leaders in this as well, right? Like, at what point do you start to draw lines? And then what do you do about it? I'm not going to say, like, it's time to piecemeal round up Russians and hold them hostage. But I mean, if Russia's holding hostage, then I suppose, you know, Russians, especially those who are shady in our midst, certainly can be rounded up. And, you know, do we have to start responding in kind in some capacity? I mean, what does this look like? And Patrick, I want to get your take on it, because the Chinese are looking, oh, wow, the Russians are getting away with high power microwave attacks that are permanently debilitating people. Okay. You know, not like they're a self-governing, you know, not that China is a paragon of self-restraint on stuff like this. Go ahead, Jim.
Well, I'd say the first thing is I don't want to draw lines unless I know the administration is going to back it up. And that's the problem with the administration right now. And I think Doug made the good point about, you know, having the nuclear capabilities that Macron is not going to be, you know, made afraid of a nuclear threat from Russia because of the nuclear capability. And that has given him confidence. And so I need to have a confidence in this administration that if we're going to start drawing lines based on Russian behavior, that they're going to back it up. And I'm not so sure that's where this administration is, particularly on this microwave thing. And I'll tell you, I have to admit, I haven't read deeply into it. And so I on this specific threat that is the fingerprints seem to be with the Russians, I personally have got to see more in terms of the evidence on this, et cetera, before I want to start drawing lines. And before I draw a line, I want to know, okay, so what will our response be, you know, if they cross the line? If we're drawing a line and the Russians just step right across it, what are we going to do then? I mean, we're not going to be able to capture and take hostage Russians, you know, this kind of thing. This is a gray zone war that we're in, and we're not real good with gray zone war. So I just don't know how this administration would respond to lines being crossed. So I don't want to draw lines yet, and I need to know more about the specific things you're talking about. I wish I could be more beating of the drums and everything on this, but on the microwave threat, what's happened and this type of thing, I need to see some more smoke, if not the fire, before I want this administration to draw lines. And I'm not sure I want them to draw a line unless I know they're going to draw a pistol if that line is crossed.
Yeah, but I mean, isn't this a pistol crossing line when your personnel in the United States are being attacked by a foreign power? Isn't that the very definition? And I appreciate that the fig leaf on this, Jim, is, you know, we need like 100% certainty. They have 100% certainty. They've actually caught Russians with the equipment, you know, in the backseat of their car running away from police after having conducted one of these attacks, right? It's possible, you know.
Well, I tell you, it is. It's
possible somebody else did it, but it's unlikely.
Again, I need to read more deeply into it, but taking it at face value, it is a pistol drawing offense, if you will. But I don't know if it's a pistol you draw or something else. It's got to be proportional, you know. It's got to be something that fits the crime. And if in fact the Russians are zapping people in their homes in the United States, and it's people jogging and all the things you're talking about, then yeah, we've got to do more than put sanctions on them. It's not bombing Moscow. I'm not sure what it is, but I don't think we can sit back and just make statements and say, you guys had better stop this. There's got to be something stronger than that. I still don't want to draw a line, but it's got to be something stronger than making statements or putting in sanctions. But I do need to see more evidence on this and have a better feel for it before I start pulling anything out of my holster.
I agree. Although I think we should also be enforcing sanctions against oligarchs' families and bad guys' families who are coming in and out of Europe, right? I mean,
oh, sure. Know, absolutely that. Oh, absolutely that.
The big guy is sanctioned, but everybody else is having a grand old time in Europe, which I don't believe is fair. Patrick,
right.
I'm going to turn to you in just a moment, but a quick word from our sponsors. The Defense and Aerospace Report and its family of publications is brought to you by HII, General Atomics Aeronautical Systems, GE Aerospace, Bell, Leonardo DRS, American Rheinmetall, and TE Connectivity. Patrick, what signal does it send to the Chinese when they see the Russians kind of getting away with literally murder and having gotten away with murder for a lot of years? people know the Russians are behind it, but they don't want to say anything because they're not really sure what to do about it, announce impotent sanctions, or when you see a case of sort of novel technology with which the United States has developed as well, and the United States decided not to use because of the dangerous nature of the technology, okay? So we also know a lot about this technology. So what signal does it send when, I mean, the world basically, there's no, you can literally get away with it, evidently.
Well, Vago, that's pretty vague. You know, when I, my father-in-law was well, seriously, I mean, we're conflating a lot of things here, and I think we need to be careful about sticking to facts. And
well, I mean, but we know factually, right? A Russian soldier who deflected to Spain was killed by Russian intelligence in Spain.
Yes.
As far as I'm concerned, that's a third country, right?
It is. That happened.
And in the case of the Havana Syndrome attacks,
which is a broader subject. That's what I was alluding to.
Understand, it's a broader subject, but we also know with a pretty high degree of confidence it is the Russians who are doing this. And, right. You know, if I'm a bad guy somewhere, I'm going to look at that and say, wow, okay, that's...
Well, extrajudicial killings, that's something that the Chinese have not been very keen on. They like abduction. They like, they like other means.
That's not funny, but okay, you take your point.
I know. But the Russians are particularly brutal when it comes to wanting to show and trying to warn anybody that if you turn on us, we will get you eventually. And they really make a point of that. The Chinese want to silence you, but they don't necessarily do it in the way that the Russians are doing it. The Havana syndrome, reason I want to be careful there, my father-in-law was, you know, in the first time he was in the American embassy in Moscow, they were still beaming pretty high microwave waves at the American embassy there. They could never prove the cause and effect of what that did, nor did they understand fully the intent. And even though they've done lots of investigations, you know, the main intent at the time, back in the Cold War, was apparently to block or to intercept radio traffic and messaging. But over time, no doubt, the KGB and FSB and other apparatus of the Russian state decided that they could... hurt people this way too. I think that's where we're just still not sure about the cause and effect between Havana syndrome and the nasty things that the Russians get up to opaquely that we can't really, you know, have full confidence that we understand what's going on. The Chinese obviously would like to get away with lots of things and do not advertise what they're doing. So in that sense, they like to emulate more of the Russian closed playbook. But at the same time, they're pretty confident of their own espionage system, of their own intellectual property theft and malware and everything else they're doing to burrow into our systems approach and silencing the diaspora through all sorts of means and silencing and countering any messages that really come back to criticize the Communist Party of China, the leadership. So they're interested in this holistic approach, but they're not beneath taking lethal action if it's in their interest. But that's not their go-to sort of play, from my understanding of the Chinese intelligence apparatus.
Let me take you to, you know, obviously a lot of news. And as we record this, we're getting news reports that there was a 4.7 earthquake in New York City. And this certainly not very significant, obviously, in a city like New York City, and somewhat less significant than the earthquake or at least we certainly hope so, than the earthquake in Taiwan. And we'll talk about that in a second. There is a yin and yang between the United States and China. Both are standing up to each other. The president and Xi Jinping had a conversation that both sides characterized as very fruitful, right? Made their positions clear. Janet Yellen was in Beijing, I think with the absurdist task of asking the Chinese not to export their green technology, their state-subsidized green technology, just as the United States is subsidizing its own green technology. I mean, I don't think she's got really a leg to stand on. I would have said, like the Chinese have said to me, we took, you know, we took this seriously. We invested in it. You didn't take it seriously. You didn't invest in it. Now you're angry that we did. They invested in it. They have the technology. They're well within their rights to export it. If we had taken it more seriously, we would have worked less on subsidizing coal jobs to the tens of thousands, as opposed to green jobs, which would be in the tens of millions. Ultimately, everybody has a choice. Stood out, in the Yellen visit and the conversation between Xi and Biden? Because both sides understand that even if they have differences, they really need each other in many respects, especially as the Chinese economy is on the rocks.
Sure. So for the first time since their summit in November in San Francisco, President Biden and Xi Jinping spoke, this time by telephone, and lasted an hour and 45 minutes with consecutive translation, so didn't get as many points across as they wanted, perhaps. And yet it was still very much a house cleaning or housekeeping sort of check-in call, as they called it, rather than some kind of substantive advanced policy discussion. And interestingly, right away, I mean, after the call, there was a readout from China that ended up being quite different from what the White House started briefing. And it was different in the sense that the Chinese like to cast everything in this very formulaic way of here are our demands and the five no's, and we'll make sure that, you know, United States will be kept in check. Whereas the White House said, look, we were able to raise our big issues that we're concerned about. Fentanyl, of course, and the follow through on that. The overcapacity issue that you've just alluded to that Secretary Yellen is still talking about in China right now as we speak. And most importantly, perhaps, was the Chinese economic support for Russia and what Kurt Campbell, the Deputy Secretary of State, said essentially is the reconstitution of the Russian military on the backs of Chinese economic support. Now, that's a pretty serious charge, and it's one that the Chinese have been trying to duck. And yet, unfortunately, there's a lot of evidence that the Chinese dual-use economy and economic support for Russia has indeed helped revitalize not just keeping Russia afloat, but really helping the Russian military reconstitute. So I think that's a big point. I think not letting this tip over into a hot war, though, not even a fierce cold war, that is the desire of Biden. But, with the election year going, this is not a year in which anybody can make many concessions to China, nor would one want to at this point. And we'll have to see after the election. I think this is why it's a housekeeping check-in as well. I think right. Xi Jinping is waiting for the election. You know, Janet Yellen, Secretary Yellen, is in Guangzhou earlier today, that she talked about essentially China's too big to flood the markets. And it's not just the Americans who are going to sort of push back with barriers, but it's what Europe is doing, what Latin American countries are worried. They're very worried that China's, it's not just the electric vehicles, but it's every manufactured good right now, heavily subsidized by China. China's using this foreign demand to make up for low consumption at home and to essentially make the economy better. So that's the concern here, that they're really flooding the markets. It's not just the EV issue that you mentioned. So in the green technology, it's really across the board on manufacturing that China is trying to flood the markets. And it's got everybody's attention. And if you read, again, Latin American press, European press, North American press, there's equal concern all around.
Let me take you, and you talked a little bit about this last week. Japanese Prime Minister Kishida is going to make a six-day visit to the United States, hammer out closer integration and command and control with U.S. and Japanese forces. Dev gave us a great talk about that. Walk us through the meeting and how these talks are actually going to bridge into the upcoming dialogue, right? The JAFAS dialogue, the Japan-Philippines-U.S. Dialogue that President Marcos is central to.
So Prime Minister Kishida arrives Monday, and he's here through Saturday. Basically, he's here the entire week, which is unusual. He'll be at the White House on the 9th, and there'll be major announcements at the White House between Biden and Kishida that will talk about really integrating the alliance overall. So not just the command and control arrangement that they may not have fully finished, but have at least put the outline on what's happening there as Japan sets up their joint command and how that's going to dovetail with an American commander who has more operational control. but it won't be a combined alliance in the sense that no leader will be in charge of both countries. It'll be two separate commands still, but more integrated. It's going to be followed up by a more integrated defense industry. That's the idea. So the shipbuilding deal that they're going to talk about, where the maintenance, repairs, and overhauls can be done, at least with U.S. ships that are already forward-based in Japan, will be a very big help. They'll also talk about a new technology agreement on chips and batteries. And they're going to talk about the increased cooperation with their lattice work of partners, including JAFIS. So that Japan-Philippines-U.S. Dialogue with President Marcos Jr. On the 11th will be a way to signal that Japan is going to be a more active security contributor to the region, including in the South China Sea. And that's going to be on the heels, by the way, the Marcos Trilateral Summit will be on the heels of a maritime exercise that begins this Sunday that will include not just these three countries, but also Australia's adding in. So that's got the attention of China, you can be sure, when you think about the to and fros we've seen over the Second Thomas Shoal and Scarborough Shoal and Tutu Island, all of the areas around the Spratlys. These are exercises, by the way, that U.S., Japan, Philippines, and Australia will be conducting off Palawan Island, you know, very close to the Spratly Island. So this is a very clear signal that Japan is here. It's not just that Japan is back, as the late Prime Minister Abe said, but Japan is now in the region as a security contributor. You know, thank you, China. Thank you very much, because, you know, you are the reason why these countries have to come together to stand up for their own sort of rules-based system, for including things like the 2016 Arbitral Tribunal ruling, including ASEAN rules and the coal regs that are meant to prevent collisions at sea. All of these are things that China is stepping on every day with ramming and shouldering and water cannoning. So this is a very important summit for the Prime Minister. And yet, despite that, and he'll be back in July for the NATO summit, he's still likely to be seen as stepping down from LDP leadership in September.
Indeed. And just a quick update, it's a 4.8 magnitude earthquake shaking the eastern seaboard, and the epicenter of it was Lebanon, New Jersey, about 50 miles west of Manhattan, being felt in Philadelphia, Manhattan, and as far north as Boston, and certainly across Long Island as well. Makes a good segue to Taiwan. Worst earthquake since 1999, demonstrated to the world the nation's preparedness, frankly, competence, resilience, as well as cohesion. At the same time, Taiwan's former Kuomintang leader, Ma Ying-jeou, was in China. Give us the message, that Taiwan just delivered to the world. What the Ma visit to Beijing means.
Sure. When you think about Chinese psychological operations, talking about President Tsai Ing-wen is prepared to leave on a U.S. plane in the event of war, completely a false report coming out just before this earthquake. And then on Weibo, a lot of national sentiment sort of mocking the Taiwanese about the earthquake. Actually, to the credit of the Chinese, they started to censor and take down those national sentiments. But I think Taiwan has been extraordinarily resilient in a very tough earthquake. A 7.3 magnitude earthquake is monumental. And the aftershocks, we talked about what just happened in New York, the aftershocks of this earthquake in Taiwan have been repeatedly in the 5-6 range. So it's been an ongoing thing since the 3rd of April. Fortunately, the epicenter was in the east coast, so not in Taipei, and not in the major population centers. Even so, your heart goes out to those who were trapped, some killed, many injured. But the resilience of the economy is apparent. The preparation is apparent. As for Ma Ying-jeou in China, this is a long trip, and it seems to be a counter-programming to Lai's inauguration next month. Because former President Ma has been talking about the need for connection between the mainland and Taiwan people. And President-elect Lai is likely to talk more about the de facto independence, if not use the word independence, of Taiwan. And that's certainly going to rankle Beijing. So Beijing wants to get ahead of that by emphasizing the fact that things are still going their way as from their narrative's perspective. And Taiwan, meanwhile, will have its inauguration party next month.
Indeed. And thanks very much for that. Dove, we've got a couple of minutes left, but we should talk about the latest in Israel's war on Gaza and the tensions that's causing with Washington. Seven World Central KitchenAid workers were killed in what was a fairly sustained airstrike on their convoy in Gaza that was fully vetted and blessed by the IDF. It was still struck. For some, this is confirmation Israel is indiscriminate in its targeting and execution. Israel said, we made a mistake and we will investigate it, although there are Washington's calling for a third party investigation. We learned that from an Israeli investigative news site, 972, that the IDF has been using AI-based targeting system called Lavender to defend, to determine who's a terrorist, rank them in order. And then, you know, there is a brief human involvement, but then the system kind of goes a little bit automatic. And those involved in it say it has, you know, but a 10% or, you know, at least a 10% miss rate. And it has a tendency of sort of initiating strikes once the terrorist returns home. But the trouble is, it could be the wrong person who returns home to an apartment building and the apartment building gets flattened too, right? That has Washington, the World Central Kitchen episode and some others, as Washington is saying, you know, gave Israel a demarche that unless you change the way you're operating, there is a humanitarian crisis. We need to get more aid in there. Unless you change the way you're operating and help get more aid in there, there's, you know, the United States is going to reconsider a change in its relationship. On the other hand, you know, Washington continues to send, you know, aircraft and arms there, which critics say is improper. Israel says, I have a right to defend myself. Israel did, in the wake of the World Central Kitchen strike, though, open up many crossings to try to get more aid into Israel. Where are we in all of this now? I'm trying to summarize this because there are a lot of moving parts to it. But what's your sense on where we are and what's next? Because, you know, even some Israelis are now saying we think Bibi is prolonging the war because he doesn't know what's going to come next. And Benny Gantz, who's in the war cabinet, has said, you know, we should have elections in September. Where are we in all of this, at a time when the president is really taking a lot of heat, you know, during the Ramadan meeting, Arab American leaders, you know, at least one of them left after expressing their concerns because they weren't particularly interested in listening to what the president had to say.
Well, let me start with the aftermath of the president's discussion with Bibi and in this case, the president really came down very hard, essentially saying, look, if you don't clean up your act, we will do something you're not going to like, which implies some kind of restriction on weapons transfers. Now, what Netanyahu did was, as you said, open up some of the crossings, although on two of them, they still use the word temporarily. So it's not clear what that means. How long is temporary? The IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, has completed its investigation, which frankly I find kind of interesting, a very quick investigation. They fired the brigade chief of staff, but he's a reservist. They fired the actual guy who's in charge of what they call the firing officer, but he's relatively junior. They reprimanded all the senior guys. They reprimanded the commander of Southern Command. They reprimanded the brigadier general below him, but they didn't fire these guys. So that's number two. One, the openings are temporary. Two, the firings. Seem to be relatively lower level. Now, the argument they make is that, well, there were these Hamas guys who came on armed onto these the vehicles and then got off, but they didn't see that these guys got off. Well, you know, when you're talking about drones that can pick off anybody inside an apartment house, it's kind of hard to understand why they couldn't see these guys getting off. They argue also, you know, sometimes the Hamas people go unarmed and then they pick up arms. Well, if they can see them picking up arms, then they could see that these guys got off the various trucks. So there's a strong case for some kind of independent investigation of this. And of course, it's not the first time this has happened. It's a couple of hundred aid workers have been hit. So all in all, the Israelis are not looking very good in this. And one other point, there's a report, and it's only a report, but it's quoting a senior Israeli official who says, at the end of the day, the local commander has total freedom in terms of what you might call the rules of engagement. Now, the Israelis have said the local guys violated the rules of engagement. But if they all can make up their own rules of engagement, what did they violate? There's a lot of questions here that just need to be answered. And finally, with regard to Gantz and the September election, what Netanyahu has said is, well, you can't change horses in the middle of a stream. Well, does that mean the war is going to go on to beyond September? What exactly does that mean? And oh, by the way, when the Brit, and I think I mentioned this last week, when the British changed horses 8 months after World War II began, the guy who replaced Chamberlain was a man named Winston Churchill. Now, I don't know if Benny Gantz, who's way ahead of Netanyahu in the polls, is a Winston Churchill, but he sure as heck is better than Netanyahu, who's still running at about 30% with more and more and larger demonstrations against him. The whole unity of the country that clearly was manifest after October 7th is starting to crack. And in part because the leadership is so incompetent. There's no other way to put it.
Let me just ask you one last question, Dov, before we go. Increasingly, you know, I mean, folks say that the problem is Bibi, but if you look at polling, Israelis are overwhelmingly supportive of the operation in Gaza to the end, whatever the end is, even if they disagree with maybe the way that it's prosecuted, although many don't. There are increasing number of Israelis that don't want to be told what to do by anybody, including the United States, right? That was a very narrow sentiment. It was more you would see on the right when you would have dinner with them, whereas now it's a much more, you know, broader expression. And the notion of a two-state solution is also really unpopular, increasingly with Israelis, right? So, you know, we try to say that some of these are Bibi issues. How much of these are Israel issues and Israel and where it wants to go being different than what people in Washington and elsewhere want? You know, I mean, it is, after all, a democracy, and democracies can go in all sorts of directions that you may not want them to go into, but they do anyway.
Well, a couple of things. First, let me talk to the two-state solution. Bibi said we're trying to force it down his throat, considering that every president from Jimmy Carter onward talked about a two-state solution. It's hardly a new idea. And the fact that a significant proportion of the population is against it, well, obviously, right now, there's emotions are running very high, and I'm not surprised that they're against it. But leadership is leadership. The majority of Americans were isolationists prior to World War II. That didn't stop Roosevelt from helping the Brits with all kinds of interesting ploys, like lend-lease and trading islands for equipment. Right. So that argument really doesn't hold very well. The other thing is, yeah, they want to pursue the war, that is the general populace, but how it's pursued, and you mentioned that just now yourself, is an entirely different issue. Right. I mean, the fact of the matter is, the Israelis have now said, we're going to be careful about aid workers. When did they say that 5 months ago? The Israelis have said, we're going to be much more careful about how we target Hamas people. Why didn't they say that 5 months ago? So the issue isn't, you know, prosecuting the war. The issue is how you prosecute the war. And if the war is prosecuted in a much more targeted fashion that the Israelis keep promising they're going to do, I don't know that that would necessarily be something that the Israeli populace would oppose. So it does come down at the end of the day to the prime minister. And the fact of the matter is that the prime minister is being criticized by his own war cabinet. I mean, after all said and done, let's remember Benny Gantz was head of the IDF. He kind of knows what he's talking about.
Correct. And a former defense minister at that. Everybody, thanks very much. Really appreciate it. Terrific conversation. As always, hope everybody has a great weekend, a great week. Look forward to having you all back again next week, because there's going to be a lot to talk about when Congress is back in session. I want to thank our audience. Thanks so very much for spending so much time with us. And a reminder to check out our award-winning weekly podcast, Cavas Ships, co-hosted by our own Chris Cavas and Chris Cervello, and sponsored by HII and GE Aerospace, who clear the fog on naval and maritime matters. The Downlink with Laura Winter, that's sponsored by TE Connectivity, who takes a thoughtful look at all things space, and the Air Power podcast that I co-host with JJ Gertler, sponsored by GE Aerospace. Thanks very much again for joining us. We'll be back again on Sunday for the Business Roundtable. We're back to regular order now that Easter is over with. Until then, hope everybody has a great weekend, and we'll see you again soon. Thanks very much.